All right, our next speaker, we are teleporting here. This is another Skype speaker, and we have Mike Konietzky here from Thing M. Mike, can you just say hi so we know we're getting you, Mike? We are not. Can you try it now? Oh, our AV guy is running up to the booth, so he's got it. I'm going to face Mike towards the audience, so he can see you very carefully. All right, I think we can hear you now, Mike. Try it again.
All right. Hi, welcome to my living room. All right. So there might be some echo as I'm talking here, so I might actually put you guys on mute for a second. So hold on. I'm on mute. Okay, can you mute on your end? Never mind. I'm just going to talk. Wait, time is limited. So, thank you very much for Alicia, Aya, and Bug for organizing this. This is a really great thing. I wish I could have been there. But let me cut to the chase since I only have 10 minutes. And as always, I think I've written way more than I have time to talk about. So my name is Mike Konietzky. I'm a co-founder of Thingam with Todd Kurt. We design and manufacture ubiquitous computing products. Our current product line is essentially things to help you bling your house, and as per the previous speaker. So we make smart LEDs. We make a line of smart LEDs. Let me give you the full pitch in case you don't know what we do. They're ultra-bright RGB LEDs that have an integrated driver that runs firmware that abstracts away the complexity of creating colored light effects. Someone with no experience with electronics, programming, or color theory can use our stuff to make a smoothly fading blinking light effect in a relatively short time without an additional microcontroller or any other hardware. Our LEDs even have input pins so they can change their behavior on the fly, and they're used in everything from car dashboard prototypes to, apparently, as we've been told, Lady Gaga's stage show. So the vast majority of our code and our designs are open, but not everything, and I'll explain why in a minute, and that's really kind of what this talk is about. But let me preface this by saying that Thingam is our day job. In the 4 years since we started, we've always treated it as a profit-making business that needs to sustain itself and us. So just as any small business, we're always thinking about money. And that frames my perspective on the value of open hardware as part of a larger business strategy. So what I want to describe today is three situations where the ideas of open hardware have intersected with our business decisions explicitly. So I haven't been watching the summit other than like the last 40 minutes, so please excuse me if this has already been covered. So case one. So we sell a product called the Maxim. This is it. So it's a two-part smart LED. There's a controller and there's an LED cluster. So when we first came out with it, one of our distributors asked us if we could sell the LED cluster by itself. And we thought, why not? And so we made a bunch. And so they sold pretty well. But we actually made very little money on each one, like about a dollar on each one, because they're like kind of, it's pretty cheap. There's not actually much that goes in here. And after the first run of them sold, I kind of ran the numbers and realized that basically for every cluster we sold, instead of selling a complete Maxim, because really to us, this is the part that has the more value. It's also the more expensive part. It's the part that we think has the more end user value too. So every one of these that we sold instead of a complete unit cost us about $5 in potential profits. And in addition, our customers got a product that wasn't actually, from my perspective, nearly as interesting as a complete Maxim. So, you know, in other words, we'd have to sell five of these to make up for every potential lost sale of a Maxim. So was that actually happening? I don't know for sure, but the numbers implied it, and there was no indication that we were in fact there were indications, I should say, that we were in fact hurting Maxim sales. So what we decided to do is we had decided to cancel this product by itself, not the Max itself, but just the cluster. And so we told our distributor that we were canceling it. And they said, sure, but if you don't mind, we're just going to make our own. It's not going to look like yours, but it'll basically be the same thing because we know they sell pretty well. And they didn't have our Gerber files or our LED suppliers, but you know, those things aren't hard to put together. It's a very simple product. And you know, we share the schematics, so it's very easy to replicate. And since they're our friends, of course I said yes, but I felt that what happened is that we had developed a product that essentially cannibalized our primary market, had developed a market for it, had proven a market for it that we couldn't actually, that wasn't actually valuable for us to serve, and then we gave that market to someone with better marketing and distribution resources for whom it could be a marginally good product line, and who would then be effectively competing with us and cannibalize sale. So what did we learn? Well, I think that what we learned is that we ended up kind of screwing ourselves twice. And if our hardware wasn't as open, we may have actually only screwed ourselves once. So would we do things differently? Probably not. But it was an interesting example of where the openness interacted with the business case. So case two. So a couple of months ago, I was having a really good conversation with a big electronics distributor and essentially trying to talk them into carrying our products. So I thought that you know things were going pretty well and that they were going to pick up our product line. And then the buyer who I was talking to very casually said, "No, so you can you send us your UL certification? You know, we don't carry things that aren't UL certified." And I said, okay, let me look into that." So I looked into it. So it costs, you know, roughly between $10,000 and $20,000 to certify each one of our products as a lighting product through UL. So to do all of our products would have cost us around $100,000 to certify. And if we wanted to get all the other certifications that are appropriate, we would probably have to spend another $100,000. So first of all, we just can't afford that flat out. But moreover, if we could, then conforming to the standards would actually require us to change our designs in very specific ways, which would be great because there's a reason for those standards to exist. But it's a really expensive product for it. And if we make our revised designs open, we would essentially be giving potential competitors the product of that standards conforming process. We'd essentially be saving them $200,000 that we had spent, putting us at an immediate financial disadvantage in terms of competing with someone who's making our stuff. Can we afford? So the question for us is, can we afford to make that gift to the community? And the answer is, I don't know. I'm still thinking about it. I'm still running the numbers. So case three. 3 years ago, about a week after we'd started selling and shipping our first product, which was the Blinkem, which looks like this, we got an email. The email was very nice. The author said that he and his company thought that our products were really interesting. But he really wanted to point out that his company had just been granted a patent on the core functionality of our product, and that he would like to have a conversation with us about it. The patent had been granted the same day that he sent the email. So it's clear that he'd actually been following our product, following our progress as we're documenting it on Flickr and on our blogs. So I immediately called our patent attorney, and he asked me to come to his office. And when I came in, he had the patent printed out, and he had the key claims highlighted in kind of a yellow highlighter. And so he kind of turned the paper around, and he pushed it to me, and he asked me whether our product did the highlighted claims. And so I said, well, you know, it definitely does these two things, and if I understand this third claim correctly, then yeah, basically does that too. And he kind of sat back, and he said, get out of that business immediately. Fortunately, we were lucky. You know, I'm stubborn and I'm optimistic. Jeff, the guy who sent us the email, was the CTO of an East Coast manufacturing company. And he said that rather than sending his lawyers, he really wanted to talk first. And he suggested that we meet the following week since he's going to be in the Bay Area. And so my patent lawyers, I talked to my patent lawyer about this, and what he said, his half-joking advice, was to not go alone and to not meet him in a hotel room. So Jeff had actually Jeff had actually suggested that we meet in a hotel room in Santa Clara and that we meet alone. Naive or optimist as I am, I said, okay. So, time is limited, I'll cut to the chase. So, it actually went very well. Jeff was actually very generous, and I didn't do anything I regretted the following morning. So, we ended up negotiating for about 6 hours and came up with a licensing agreement that allowed us to use his company's IP for free, but we could not make products outside of a specifically defined market. We could not share the technology with its competitors, and the IP was not transferable to anyone who bought our product. So if someone, if someone made something with our product that crossed into his company's market, he would treat it as patent infringement, and we would be held at least partially responsible. That was the only way they were actually going to be able to bring our product to market. Otherwise, they weren't going to grant us the license. But what we ended up doing is we ended up having to make the core part of our product, the firmware, not open. It's actually a trade secret. Since by making it open, we would essentially be enabling his competitors to compete against him, directly violating the agreement that we had made. So it was actually a very interesting learning experience, because what I realized is that IP, whether it's open or it's controlled by patents or trade secrets, has actually a different quality when it's held by small companies than the patent portfolio is held by large companies. The large companies think of themselves as kind of knights in armor and treat IP like a battle axe they use against each other. But for small companies, if you're dealing with someone who's reasonable, like Jeff was, a patent or even an open hardware design is actually just a letter of introduction between two companies with a mutual interest in the same technology. So that interest is, or should be, to do mutually beneficial business with each other. And that's actually how I've treated IP ever since. We've actually ended up filing some patents and creating some trade secrets. Most of our products are open. We make the choice as to whether we make something open or not open based on how we feel it's going to be, how we feel it's going to affect our business. We feel that for the most part, openness is great, but sometimes for us to have a successful business, can't be as open as we like in an absolute sense. We have to decide everything on a case-by-case basis. So the main thing I learned from these three experiences, there's actually many shades of gray in open hardware where it meets money. So I try to keep things as open as possible, but every single decision I make about what we do with a company and its IP has a direct effect on the financial health of the company, in the short term and the long term. So openness is a great strategy for long-term technological influence, and perhaps for profits. All right, done. But it carries with it short-term and long-term costs that calculated as part of it. So that's it. Thank you. Thank you.